Dave received his new driver's license in the mail at the beginning of October. It was accompanied by a letter which began, "Dear Sir, we were pleased to note that you're no longer required to wear corrective lenses." Dave's never worn glasses in his life. Somewhere in the pit of his stomach, he felt a queasy twinkle, like the birth of a star in a galaxy he felt he should be able to name. "Before we can change the category code on your driver's license," the note continued, "we must receive confirmation from an ophthalmologist of this change in your vision." Dave's vision hasn't changed in 20 years. The star in his stomach was burning brightly now. "Ah," thought Dave, "I know the name of this galaxy. It's the galaxy of bureaucratic horror." With a sinking heart, he finished the note. "We have reissued your permit subject to the following conditions." At the bottom of the letter it said, "Driver must wear corrective lenses." Somehow Dave knew this wasn't going to be easy. That was 2 months ago. And Dave still hasn't even made a half-hearted attempt to make a doctor's appointment. Truth be known, he's been too busy these last few weeks to think about his license. This is the busiest time of the year if you work in retail. And although things never get out of hand at Dave's record store, it has been busy enough. Busy enough that last Saturday morning, when Morley reminded Dave that they were going to Ted and Polly Anderson's annual Christmas at home, Dave gave her a look which said, "Please say I can stay home and watch the hockey game." And Morley said, "Don't look at me like that. We have to go." And Dave said, "Okay, but let's go early and get out early." And that's how Dave came to be standing impatiently in his driveway, yelling at his 9-year-old son, Sam, on Friday evening at 5:30, "Just come without your jacket," he said. "You don't need your jacket. The car's warmed up. Just come. Just hurry." They were, as it turns out, the first to arrive. They actually rang the Andersons' bell 10 minutes before they were invited to, which was early enough that Polly Anderson hadn't finished setting things out. "I told you so," said Dave's daughter, Stephanie, who's 17. "It's okay," said Dave. "We'll help out." And that's how Dave came to be standing over two identical bowls of eggnog, holding an open bottle of rum, helping out. "The Lalique crystal is for the adults," called Polly Anderson from the kitchen. "The glass bowl's for the kids." Dave took a step back and peered at the two bowls. Crystal glass or glass crystal? Which is the Lalique?" he called. And then the doorbell rang, and Polly said, "The Lalique's on the left. Can you get the door?" And Dave said, "Just a second." And then the doorbell rang again, and Dave frowned and said to himself, "Glass left and crystal right, or crystal left and glass right?" And from the dining room, Morley said, "Dave, get the door." And he ran for the door. And Polly said, "Dick, will you take the eggnog downstairs for the kids?" Morley has always left Polly Anderson's Christmas at home feeling defeated and inadequate. Defeated by Polly Anderson's spiral staircase, by her Lalique crystal, and her bonsai collection in the hall, which this year she decorated with miniature lights she had pried out of her son's electric train set. Defeated by the moment at the end of each year's party, a moment that was not unpleasant, but just so perfect. When everyone gathered around the Andersons' Christmas tree, which was always taller and straighter than any tree Dave and Morley had ever found, and Dick lit the real candles, and they turned off the lights and they sang carols. Defeated by these things that the Andersons seemed to do so effortlessly. Their kids were so polite and well-dressed, and most galling, so clean. It all made Morley feel inadequate, all of it, but the thing that really ground her down was the mountain of food that Polly produced every year. This year it was Christmas sushi. Pieces of salmon twisted into the shape of fir trees. Little tuna reefs. Monkfish angels with oyster shell wings. And in the middle of the table, a seaweed manger with a baby Jesus made from salmon roe. And three wise men with pickled ginger robes and wasabi faces. And crackers. Crackers with exotic spreads. Polly Anderson's crackers were better dressed than half the people at the party. It was as if Polly Anderson had Martha Stewart working for her in the kitchen. Like Martha Stewart had gone berserk back there and any moment now was going to march out carrying something on a silver platter. Like a stenciled roast beef. Or maybe something endangered, like flaming brandied seal flippers with minced whooping crane and penguin sauce. The last time that she had entertained the Andersons, Morley was so determined to measure up that she'd gone to the library and checked out a pile of Martha Stewart's magazines, and then she'd come home and rolled cylinders of salami in a soft cream cheese dip and stuck toothpicks at each end of the rolls, and it didn't occur to her until Sam pointed it out that the tray she had just carried into the living room looked like a plate of miniature toilet paper rolls. She went right back out to retrieve it and saw Polly Anderson looking at the plate quizzically. And then watched Polly Anderson pick up one of her miniature toilet roll hors d'oeuvres and watched her bring it toward her mouth and then watch it slide off the toothpicks halfway there. It landed in her drink. Morley went right back into the kitchen and stayed there until Dave forced her to join them in the living room. As Morley stood in the Andersons' hall last Friday night, staring at Polly Anderson's crackers, she was thinking of the days following her party. For days, she kept coming across little piles of her toilet paper hors d'oeuvres all over her house, under the couch, in the drawer where she kept her checkbook, in the bathroom garbage can, on a windowsill. All of them had one bite missing. Morley was standing in the hall watching Dave, who seemed to be following a plate of shrimp around, when Dick Anderson came up behind her and made her jump. He said, "Are you all right?" And Morley thought, "Was I talking out loud?" And Dick said, "Can I get you a drink?" Gliding through his house in a gray suit jacket and one of those collarless shirts buttoned to the neck. Morley looked across the room at Dave. He was wearing the blue sweater his mother had knitted him for Christmas last year. It had a map of Cape Breton on the front. with a large red dot marking his hometown. One side of his shirt was hanging out from under the sweater. Morley had already had three cups of eggnog, but she just couldn't seem to relax. "Sure," she said, holding out her cup. The party seemed stiffer than usual, though the kids seemed to be having a whale of a time. Sam had wound by her a few moments ago with a plate piled with bread and salmon mousse. "You'd never eat that at home," thought Morley, not saying it out loud. "This is the mousse," said Sam exuberantly, pointing to the orange spread. "And this," he said, pointing to the gelatin, "is the mousse fat." And he snorted and wheeled back toward the basement where the kids were. And when he opened the basement door, the sounds of children singing Christmas carols came wafting boisterously up the stairs. Dave caught Morley's eye across the crowded living room. He smiled and shrugged, and then he turned and followed Polly Anderson, who was carrying the plate of shrimp, into the library. Jim Schofield, who was coming out of the library as Dave was going in, punched him in the shoulder and whispered into his ear, "You cooking the turkey again this year, Dave?" The ghost of Christmas past. Dave abandoned the shrimp and headed back to the punch bowl and poured himself another glass of eggnog, his fifth. He couldn't seem to loosen up. 45 minutes later, Bernie Schellerman lurched by Dave on his way upstairs. Bernie looked like he was being chased by wolves. He was holding his five-month-old daughter in his arms. The baby was howling. "Every night," said Bernie. "When you try to put her down," said Dave. "She screams for 2 hours," said Bernie. And Dave, who was looking for any excuse to leave the Andersons, said, "Get your coat." Now, Sam, Dave's son Sam, came out of the womb screaming. And every night at bedtime, for the first 2 years of his life, he'd lie in his crib and he'd scream. And Morley and Dave would sit in the kitchen as rigid as a pile of lumber and listen to him and say things to each other like, "We're not going in there. We're not going in there tonight. Sit down. He has to learn. Come back." Other parents from the neighborhood would find excuses to drop in on Dave and Morley around bedtime, because listening to Sam always made them feel better about their own kids. If mothers were becoming short-tempered with their children, fathers would say, "Could you nip over to Morley's and see how they're coming with Ida?" He'd just make something up. And the wives would go because they knew it would do them good. People who didn't have children were horrified the way Dave and Morley could offer them coffee and carry on a conversation as if nothing were happening. They'd keep glancing toward the stairs and look at each other, and then when they left, they'd say things like, "That was unbelievable. Our children will never do that." And on the rare nights when Sam stopped crying in, say, under an hour, Dave and Morley would look at each other nervously, and someone would say, "Maybe I should go and check him." And of course, Sam was usually faking. And as soon as they opened the bedroom door, he'd start crying again. Once Dave crawled into Sam's room on his belly and pulled himself up the side of the crib like a snake, only to come face to face with his kid. And then Dave slid back down the bed again. And Sam smiled and waved. And waited until Dave had made it halfway across the room before he started to cry. They lived like this for a long time before Dave discovered the car. He took Sam with him to the grocery store one night. And Sam drifted off to sleep in his car, just like that. Dave came back and said, "I'm going to try that again." And he did the next night. And it worked again. So every night, Dave loaded Sam into the car and he drove him around the neighborhood until he fell asleep. He had to drive less and less each night. Soon Sam was falling asleep within a block of the house, and then one night he nodded off before Dave got out of the driveway. It actually got to the point where Dave could put Sam in the back seat, start the car, and just idle it in the driveway for a while. And goodnight Sam would be gone in 5 minutes. Sometimes it helped if he revved the engine. It was something about the sound of the motor. And then one night, instead of putting him in the car, Dave put Sam in his crib and he said to Morley, "Watch this." And he got the vacuum cleaner out. And he carried it into Sam's bedroom and he turned it on and he left the room and shut Sam's door behind him. And 5 minutes later, when they opened his door, Sam was out cold. By the time he was 14 months, they could put him to sleep by waving the hairdryer over him a couple of times. Bernie Schellerman was standing on the stairs at the Andersons' party, his screaming daughter in his eyes, listening intently, nodding. "Get your coat," said Dave again, "you'll see." And then he said, "I'm going to bring Sam." He was thinking, after all of those years, he's thinking his son should see what he put him through. Dave went down to the basement. All the kids, there were about 20 of them, all the kids were at the other end of the rec room, pressed around the Andersons' upright piano, all of them, including Sam, who to Dave's astonishment had his arms draped frat house-like around the shoulders of a girl Dave had never seen before. Dave couldn't see who was at the keyboard, but he recognized the tune. It was the North Atlantic Squadron. "Away, away with fife and drum, here we come, full of rum, looking for women dead." Suddenly, someone noticed Dave, and the piano stopped, and Sam said, "Hi, Pops!" And he jumped towards his father and caught his foot on the edge of the piano stool and came down hard on middle C with his face leading. And all the kids applauded, and Sam bowed, blood dripping from his nose, and said, "Our family motto is, there are sewers aplenty yet to dig." And then he wiped his nose, smearing blood across his face and shirt, and Dave said, "You're coming with me." And then Dave said, "Where is your other shoe?" And Sam said, "Beats me." And Dave said, "Forget it." And he picked his son up and carried him out to the car. And it only took 20 minutes before the Shellerman baby was snoozing comfortably. Bernie said, "Geez, I'm going to have to buy a car." And then from the back of the car, Sam said, "It's the physics of baseball that's always fascinated me." Dave looked at his boy in the rearview mirror. Sam waved absently at his father, and then he pressed his face to the window and started to sing something that sounded like opera. "Carmen," thought Dave. "Two crazy kids at odds with a world they never made," said Sam. Dave slammed on the brakes and the car squealed to a stop by the side of the road, and Dave twisted around in his seat and stared at his son and said, "What have you been drinking?" And Sam said, "Eggnog." And Dave said, "From which bowl?" And Sam said, "From the leak bowl in the basement, of course." And Dave thought, uh-oh. And Bernie Shellerman said, "Dave?" And Dave looked at Bernie, and then he looked at Sam, and then he looked at Bernie again, and Bernie pointed out the front window, and Dave squinted into the darkness and spotted the three police officers standing on the edge of the road a half a block away. They were manning one of those roadside checks for drunk drivers, and Dave had just fishtailed to a stop in front of them. The cops all had their hands on their hips. The street light shining from behind them made them look like stormtroopers from a Star Wars movie. The only thing Dave could do was put his car into gear and creep towards them. Sam pulled himself forward so his head was beside his father's. "This," he said, "is an area of jurisprudence that has always interested me." Dave pulled up beside the police and rolled down his window and smiled, soberly. The cop didn't try to engage in small talk. He said, "Let me see your license." Then he said, "Where are your glasses?" Then he handed Dave a little machine and said, "Blow." It's hard to say who was more surprised to find there was no alcohol whatsoever in Dave's bloodstream. After all, he'd had 6 cups of eggnog. The horrible truth was slowly dawning on him when Sam joined the conversation from the back. "Can I blow too?" he said. And Dave said, "Maybe that's not a good idea." And the cop, who was being a lot friendlier now, said, "It's okay, I don't mind." And Sam blew into the little machine. And the cop pointed at it and said, "See, son, if you'd been drinking, the lights," and then his voice trailed off. And he squinted at his machine, and he took a step backwards, and he looked at Dave, who shrugged and smiled, and the cop said, "Son, I want you to get out of the car." And Sam slid over to the far side of the back seat and said, "Come and get me, copper." And then he threw up. By the time Dave got back to the party, the Andersons' house was dark and locked up. He slowed down, and then he drove by it twice. But he didn't stop. Just kept going. Sam was asleep in the back seat. Just like the old days, thought Dave. He didn't stir when Dave got him home and carried him upstairs. Morley was waiting in the living room. At first he didn't see her. The whole house was dark except for the colored lights glowing on the Christmas tree. "I love it like this," she said. Dave poured 2 drinks. It took them a while to piece their stories together. It took me 5 minutes to get Sam out of the car, said Dave. And when I did, I put him down beside the cop, and he had blood all over him, and he didn't have a winter coat, and he was missing a shoe, and he was drunk. He looked like he just left Mike Harris's Christmas party. Cheap shot. Sam and Stephanie were upstairs, safe in bed. Everything was going to be okay. Morley and Dave felt like they could laugh about the night now, had to laugh about the night. Morley told him everything that he had missed. It was like a frat house on a homecoming weekend, said Morley. Told him about Pia Cherbanovsky, 4 years old, who got herself into and halfway up the Anderson's Christmas tree. No one had noticed Pia until Dick Anderson had begun to light the candles for the carolsing. Pia had blown them out as fast as Dick could light them. At one point, said Morley, there were 10 adults around the tree trying to coax her down with candy. Then she told him about the McCormick baby. He was missing for half an hour. He finally turned up asleep in a laundry hamper, with the youngest Anderson boy squatting beside him. Bobby Anderson had wrapped himself in a large green terry cloth towel. I'm the three wise men, said Bobby, and that's the baby Jesus. Sam was never able to tell Dave the name of the girl he had his arms around in the basement. No one seemed to know who she was. She was in a red dress, said Dave. When I left, said Morley, there was a girl in a red dress standing at the top of the Anderson spiral staircase singing, "Don't Cry for Me, Argentina," at the top of her lungs. The only child who wasn't sick, singing, or passed out was their daughter, Stephanie. I told her I was proud of her, said Morley. It wasn't until much later that the truth of that dawned on Dave. Stephanie was the only kid drinking from the adult bowl. Dear God, said Morley. Merry Christmas, said Dave. Peace on earth. God bless us, everyone.